supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Happiness. In our culture, whether you think about it as an emotion or a state of being, we want it, and we want it now. But what if happiness isn't entirely good for us? What if the self-help books we read, the apps we use, and the seminars we attend are somehow off the mark, and happiness is not the end-all after all, and instead, it has a downside? On today's show, we'll talk about the pursuit of happiness and how we obsess over it. And to do this, we'll entertain this notion of there being a dark side to the quest. And we'll have some help from two psychologists in the field of positive psychology. They are June Gruber at Yale University and Dacher Keltner at UC Berkeley. We'll hear from him later in the show. We're going to start things off with June Gruber, one of the authors of A Dark Side of Happiness, How, When, and Why Happiness is Not Always Good. She teaches at Yale and directs their Positive Emotion Psychopathology Lab. I spoke with June recently about her research. In his book Stumbling on Happiness, Dan Gilbert raises the question about whether or not we know what happiness is in the first place. We feel happy when we eat an ice cream sundae or go to a movie where everyone lives happily ever after, but there's a different kind of happiness. I just saw my grandson Sam throw out the first pitch of a Washington Nationals game, and that's going to stay with me probably for the rest of my life. So what is it?
That's sort of the million-dollar question, right? We're all wondering what happiness is. And at the same time, there's this really emphatic interest in happiness, right? It's ingrained in our society. And so the question, what is happiness, becomes really important. And the field has made some progress, and what we think happiness is now is a really broad construct. But what psychology researchers think about happiness is that it includes three main parts or components. One of them is sort of experiencing what you mentioned, more positive emotion, having the pleasure when you have, you know, a delicious ice cream sundae, or, you know, spending time with friends or family. You have this sort of pleasurable, positive emotional feelings. The second component, not surprisingly, is decreased negative emotion. So individuals who are suffering from, let's say, depression or anxiety, some people might say part of what makes them, quote, happier after undergoing psychotherapy is a decrease in their negative feelings. And then the third component that people talk about that is sort of part of the, you know, happiness umbrella is general life satisfaction. So this is sort of asking yourself, you know, thinking broadly, you know, how satisfied am I with where my life is right now? Taking a broad, you know, scope and assessment of, you know, your past circumstances, where you are now and where you'd like to be. So it's more positive, less negative, and more sort of life satisfaction.
You're talking by and large about a feeling of happiness or an emotion of happiness. There are happy people. I mean, I'm thinking about the state versus trait thing, and there are people that kind of live in a happy state.
So are those people happy people, so to speak? Is someone on a day-to-day basis who has sort of high happiness, they're feeling good, they're feeling pleasurable, is that truly happiness? I think I would say that the answer to that question is not necessarily so, and maybe for two reasons. One of them is that some of the work that we do in my lab, and that some of my colleagues in the field of, you know, happiness research has found, is that feeling happier isn't always a sign of happiness, isn't always a sign of, you know, good mental functioning. And in fact, we found that people who feel a high degree of happiness, you know, too frequently and too intensely, actually are associated with a variety of negative outcomes, ranging from mental illness to engaging in risk-taking behaviors, you know, in recreational substance abuse to an extreme sexual promiscuity. So that actually just having a high level of happiness isn't always good, especially when you're experiencing it to an extreme level. So I would say feeling happy isn't always a true sign of happiness or a healthy kind of happiness, I would say.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing, June, is somebody who's almost manic. You know, that kind of happy where it bridges on mental illness.
Right. So some of the examples that I mentioned, we actually have indeed found in doing research with people who have a history of mania, where we found that people with mania are sort of on this, if you think of happiness as on a continuum, they're at the very upper extreme levels. And at those upper extreme levels in people with mania, we're seeing that the potential benefits of happiness for us almost unwind or fall apart. But we also find that high levels of happiness, even in people without any history of mania whatsoever, is also associated with some not-so-fortunate outcomes. There's work showing that high levels of happiness or cheerfulness in school-age children actually predicts a greater mortality risk, you know, later on into their middle and older adulthood.
Well, I've got to stop you there because I'm already hearing hundreds of listeners right now saying, that doesn't make any sense at all. I'm listening through a parent's ears, and, and what I'm hearing is, I don't want my child to be too happy because it could be lethal later.
It's about the degree of happiness and about the kind of happiness.
Are we really after happiness, or is it about well-being?
I think it's a really good question. You know, is some of this work that we're seeing now coming out that's telling us happiness is a more nuanced idea or concept? I think what we're finding is that there's these different varieties of happiness. I wouldn't say it's just pleasure or just well-being. What I would say is there's different varieties or flavors of what people call happiness. There's different flavors of happiness when we talk about, you know, the extent to which it connects us with other people, so feelings of compassion, feelings of love, as opposed to the extent to which it's more self-oriented, you know, feelings of pride when we feel really happy about an achievement or an accomplishment we've made. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think there's a landscape of happiness, and some of the work that researchers are doing, some of it's touching on this sort of general idea of life satisfaction or well-being, and some of it's looking more at, you know, momentary experiences of pleasure accumulated over time, and what can that tell us about, you know, our general health and well-being, you know, physically and mentally.
June, you said earlier that happiness has become ingrained in our culture.
Yeah, it really seems to be a recent sort of cultural emergence, this almost obsession or curiosity surrounding happiness, right? People are wondering, what is happiness? How can I maximize happiness in my everyday life? And what's the right way to pursue happiness? Here's where I think it started. So as you know, a lot of work, especially done, you know, in the realm of clinical psychology, you know, originally focused a lot on human suffering. So trying to understand almost the nature, the origin of almost these negative emotional experiences, people suffering from depression, anxiety, even severe forms like psychosis. And so a lot of work on well-being was focused on alleviating human suffering. And then I think the pendulum sort of swung back and said, well, that's very important that we focus on how to alleviate suffering, but what we're neglecting here is trying to focus on how we can understand almost, I think, the light side of humanity. What are the things that help us flourish? What are the, you know, things that make us most happy, that give us meaning? And from this pendulum swinging back emerged the field of positive psychology, you know, spearheaded by people like, you know, Marty Seligman, Barbara Fredrickson, Sonia Lyubomirsky, trying to say that, look, we've neglected this other really important part of humanity, the positive side of it, the things that make us feel pleasure and give us meaning. And that's sort of where it came from. And I think since that's been a new concept, a new focus, it's really taken off. And that's why you see this sort of dramatic emphasis on it, you know, seeing a lot of self-help books, you know, The How of Happiness, The Happiness Project, like you said, Stumbling on Happiness. And I think now what's happening, and some of the work that I've been focusing on, is appreciating this positive side of humanity, but also saying, look, we want to not take it too far, you know, and say that happiness is always a good thing. And we'd want to appreciate its nuances, too. In what context is it best for us?
So,
you know, at what degree? For what reasons?
So it sounds like you're in charge of regulating that pendulum, which is swung, you know, from suffering to happiness, and you want to bring it back towards the middle. Let me reintroduce you. You're listening to Voices in the Family, and I'm Dan Gottlieb. I'm speaking with psychologist June Gruber. She's the director of the Positive Emotion and Psychotherapy Lab at Yale, and she's got some new research out about the dark side of happiness. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our talk with June Gruber. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Dacher Keltner at UC Berkeley, and of course, take your calls. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Parents, do you feel like you are losing your teenager to drugs and alcohol? If substance abuse is causing changes in your relationship with your child and you don't know where to go, the Family Training Program is conducting a research study that may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to individual sessions with a family specialist, which may help you regain control of your family. This study is held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or IAmConcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY. Teens interested in journalism can use WHYY's production equipment to create news stories based on their interests during the Young Journalist Summer Camp. And for budding young filmmakers, the WHYY Film Academy teaches students to produce their own short films from script to screen. Learn from professionals. Express your ideas. Both camps are for students currently in 9th to 12th grade. Learn more at whyy.org/HamiltonCommons or 215-351-0511.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're speaking with Jane Gruber about the pursuit of happiness and the so-called dark side of happiness. June teaches psychology at Yale, and she runs their Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Lab. June has written The Dark Side of Happiness, How, When, and Why Happiness is Not Always Good. Well, I asked her to talk about the part of her research that deals with there being a wrong time for happiness.
Right. You know, we know that happiness has all these fantastic benefits for us socially, cognitively, even physically. And I think because of that, few people have asked the question, can there actually be certain contexts or times where happiness doesn't always, you know, confer these lovely benefits? What we found is that, you know, happiness is not always adaptive in every context or every situation. Maybe most, maybe many, just not every single one. And here's why. Happiness is a type of, you know, what people call an affective state or an emotion. And we know that happiness, because of this, has a certain important function for us in our lives. And that function is usually enacted or, you know, bound to a certain kind of context. So we know that happiness has one function of helping us be more cooperative with other people, more cooperative, more collaborative. And so what we found, one of my colleagues, Maya Tamir, found that in situations that actually require you to be less cooperative and actually more competitive, so she looked at competitive computer games, but you could imagine this might also apply to athletics, that in those situations, people who were in a happy mood actually performed worse on competitive tasks compared to participants actually in an angry mood, interestingly enough, suggesting that in some contexts, happiness may not always be most advantageous.
So let's talk about negative emotions, because they can have an important function in our lives, just like physical pain. I guess they alert us to the fact that, there's something wrong somewhere that has to be addressed.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting is that people have somehow, you know, equated in their mind, you know, happiness equals good and negative emotions equal bad. And this is so far from the truth. I mean, like what you were saying, all of these emotions are important for us. Happiness is just as important for us as sadness or anger or even disgust. These feeling states give us important information about the world around us. And what we found with respect to negative emotion is that, you know, even when people are trying to sort of pursue happiness or become happy, what they can't forget about is the negative emotions, right? This is part of our life and is not a bad thing. And it actually seems like negative emotion can help serve a variety of important functions, and one of them is just to help maintain a grounded perspective. Sadness also helps us appreciate loss in our lives. Disgust tells us when there's something, you know, noxious in the environment around us that we need to stay away from. So if we didn't have these emotions or didn't have fear, for example, you know, we might, you know, embark into really dangerous situations, blissfully happy. So it's really important to feel negative emotions, too. And I think what research has found is that what's most important is striking a balance between positive emotions like happiness and negative emotions, be it sadness or anger or disgust, and that there's a kind of a crucial ratio or crucial balance where researchers have found that roughly, you know, three positive experiences for every one negative experience has been associated with individuals who experience more flourishing lives, have greater healthy psychological outcomes. So the 3-to-1 ratio is one way we think about the balance, but I think the more important part is really just striking that balance.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the culture we live in, negative emotions are associated with pathology, and, you know, big pharma comes up with ways to fix normal grief and an appropriate sadness, which is kind of troubling. And I think, you know, the field of positive psychology may have contributed to that.
I don't know if any field's responsible for it, but I do think there's one way of people thinking that seems to sort of push negative emotions to the side and say that the one focus we should have is narrowly on just there's happiness at the end of the tunnel, I need to get there as soon as possible, and, you know, once I reach it, experience it at the greatest level possible. And I think what that does is not only neglects all the other emotions that make our life diverse and interesting, but actually by narrowly focusing on just wanting to be happy, recent research has found that that actually sets you up to be less happy.
Well, we know that striving puts people at risk anyway, striving for almost anything. And if it's the focus is so narrow, striving adds cortisol and stress hormones in your veins, whether you're striving for happiness or whatever.
Yeah, that's a really good point about striving. And one thing that may be unique to the striving for happiness is what it does is it actually sets up these expectations. You know, I'm striving for happiness. I therefore have some level, some ideal state of happiness that I need to reach or I really want to be at. And what some of the work by my colleagues has found is that those people who strive for happiness the most and set up these expectations in their mind of where they need to be, that those are the people that become more easily disappointed. And they become more disappointed especially in contexts that they think they should be happy. So watching in some experiments, people have looked at these people who are sort of happiness strivers while they're watching, you know, happy or amusing film clips, and found that they actually experience less joy and less happiness in the very context where most people experience some happiness, right? Because they've set up these expectations and sort of set themselves up for disappointment, too, by focusing so emphatically on the outcome, well, as opposed just living in the moment and letting happiness flow as it will.
Yeah, and we know that pursuing happiness is like trying to grab a cloud.
Right. It's hard to know exactly what you're trying to strive for. And I think the trouble with it is it's focusing less on, you know, savoring activities or life choices that are meaningful to you and really just focusing a lot on the outcome. So rather than, you know, hanging out with friends because they're people whose company is really important to you and who you feel connected to, I think sometimes the shift can be away from that and more on, if I hang out with them, then I'm going to feel happy. And that's the motivating reason why I'd hang out with them. So I think when you focus too much on the outcome, you sort of lose sight of the actual activities or things you're doing in the moment.
Juna, a great Buddhist master, said this about happiness. He said, whatever joy there is in this world all comes from desiring others to be happy. And whatever suffering there is in this world all comes from desiring myself to be happy. Ultimately, isn't happiness a byproduct of a life well-lived, one where there's meaning when we're helping make the world a better place, a life of gratitude and love?
You know, we find that the biggest predictor of happiness isn't money, isn't fame, isn't, you know, a job promotion or living in your perfect house. It's feeling like you have meaningful relationships with people around you, your partner, your, you know, friend, child, you know, other relative. And that it's really this deeper meaning and connection with other people around us that really seems to be, you know, what promotes long-lasting happiness. And I think, too, an important point to keep in mind is that the desire for happiness is not the same thing as happiness, right? But the desire is a wanting. And when you want something so bad, and it's happiness, that it's actually setting yourself up for cravings of what you don't have, setting up expectations of what you need to have, you know, as opposed to just accepting your current state as you are, how you're feeling in this moment, and sort of letting happiness come as it will, as you know, and in the meantime, just engaging in things that are meaningful to you, that enrich your social life, and that, you know, form healthy, you know, lifestyles and habits.
I have to make this observation. When I looked at your paper and I saw the title of it, The Dark Side of Happiness, I just have to say that, with all due respect, it's a little weird, you know? I mean, how did you get interested in the downside of happiness?
I think it came from the observation that we've been taking as a society this narrow focus on happiness as always a good thing. No matter what, just be, you know, don't worry, be happy, and everything good in life will follow. And I think really I found that statement unusual in the sense that it was really one-sided. And what we know in life, though, is that everything has two sides, you know, even happiness. And so I originally actually got involved in research when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, looking at the ways in which happiness does promote flourishing, does promote well-being. And I learned a lot. Some of the things we've talked about today, the ways in which happiness broadens our scope of thinking, builds relationships, promotes physical and mental health. But like I said earlier, it seemed that humans were much more complex. And I think I really started to explore this other side of happiness during my graduate studies when I began working with people suffering from mental illness, in particular exposed to, you know, what clinical psychologists refer to as mania or a phase of bipolar disorder illness. Granted, this was an extreme example of people who had persistent feelings of feeling good or high or excited, feeling on top of the world, and at the same time, you know, devastating their social relationships, often, you know, wiping out bank accounts, taking really risky decisions and behaviors. But I thought, wow, this is an extreme example. But is it possible that even people who don't have a history of mania, that there may be sometimes, some ways, some forms where happiness isn't always good for us? So when I thought about it that way, it didn't seem like such a strange question. I think what it really took me to was the conclusion that happiness is no exception, that too much of it too often or for the wrong reason can be harmful. And I think we could apply this statement to other, you know, states like sadness. Too much sadness is bad for us.
It comes back to the original question I asked about happiness is ice cream, but too much ice cream is not real good either. June, I want to thank you so much for your time and your research. It's provocative, but the highest compliment I can pay is that it's really thought-provoking. So thanks so much for the work you do and the time you spent with us.
Thank you for having me on today.
You've been listening to my interview with psychologist June Gruber. She teaches psychology at Yale, and she also runs their positive emotion and psychopathology lab. Her book, A Dark Side of Happiness, How, When, and Why Happiness is Not Always Good. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to hear from Dacher Keltner. He teaches psychology at UC Berkeley, and he's written about having a more meaningful life. When we come back, we'll also take your calls. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear your thoughts and experiences about happiness, the good news and the bad news. Well, we are talking about happiness and its dark side. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious, worried, on edge? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of worry and anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
You've probably seen him on Rachel Ray touting the transformative power of cosmetic treatments, but now Dr. Anthony Yoon tells us how he was transformed from a gawky Asian kid growing up in an all-white town to celebrity surgeon. And let's just say the desire to do good was only part of it.
We're doctors because we want to help people, but also because we want to help ourselves.
Dr. Anthony Yoon on his new memoir, In Stitches, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about happiness and perhaps its dark side. Now we're going to be talking with Dacher Keltner. He's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, the director of the Greater Good Science Center. And he's written Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Dacher, welcome to the show.
For having the show on happiness.
My pleasure. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd like to hear your thoughts, your experiences about happiness, about its dark side, and what you believe can be done to cultivate happiness. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, Dacher, you've written the Ten Commandments for happiness, and the very first commandment you wrote is that you have to laugh. Well, you know, there you go. So, I love laughter, and I think it's healing, but the first commandment, I read that and I thought, this guy's got to be kidding.
Why would something so non-serious be the first commandment in happiness?
Yeah, it's a serious study.
Yeah, well, so, you know, what we're finding, Dan, is that, first of all, laughter, as many of your listeners probably would intuit, has all these wonderful health benefits. You know, it calms your cardiovascular response. It has benefits for your well-being. And then I think something we often underappreciate is that that laughter, the right kind, of course, connects you to other people and is contagious and brings delights. And the reason I put that as my first commandment is that, you know, as a parent of two teen kids in today's very competitive, tense, anxious world, I see one of the major difficulties kids and families facing is really a shortage of play and laughter, and to not take ourselves so seriously. That's why I put it number one.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I grew up and I was raised by two moderate to severely neurotic parents. I mean, good people, but you know,
yeah.
There were like three plus neurotic. But you know, the beauty is that my parents just didn't take themselves very seriously, and that changes everything.
It does, and my dad taught me that as well. I was a tense little kid, and I just remember his play and his foolishness and the genius behind it that taught me that even in our most gravest failures, we learn and we grow, and it's okay.
Well, I want to go a little further on that continuum, because
sure.
One of your commandments is to revere, and
yeah.
And this is an emotion that I call awe, A-W-E. And I, you know, I noticed that most of us work our butts off for 50, 51 weeks a year to go to see something beautiful just so we can experience awe. And it's right here. I mean, those sunsets and sunrises and I mean, it's all right here, a tree.
Yeah.
You know, we
what a great analysis, Dan. You know, I think, and this is why we study emotions, right? And I like that you prioritize reverence, and because it does, you know, for 2,500 years, the Greeks and the Chinese and many different traditions have written about reverence. And it is something subtler than awe, but it's just right in that family of experiences, and it is about finding the sacred and the beautiful in the moment right now. You know, what a great skill to cultivate.
Well, you know, the other part of it is it we have to realize our smallness in order to do that. I'm reminded of a line in a poem by Rilke where he says, "I am too small in this world and not small enough to make every moment holy."
Yeah.
That's why we love Rilke.
You just gave me a charge to my vagus nerve, which is associated with reverence and awe. So
yeah,
beautiful poem.
It's true. Let's go to the phones here, Dr.
Sure.
We've got Tia on the line.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate this conversation. I recently had a discussion with some coworkers. It was a while ago, actually, but we were discussing happiness and marriage, and many people even justified getting a divorce because you don't feel happy. And I think that speaks to the issue of pursuing happiness. And my own personal perspective, I'm a very spiritual person, is that it's based on your perspective in life as opposed to the pursuit of the emotion. If you have a particular perspective, you'll experience more joy and happiness as opposed to pursuing the actual feeling.
What perspective?
Perspective is how you see things. You know, when you experience good and bad, it's how you take it in. If you decide to dwell on the negative, then you probably won't experience as much happiness and joy. But if you decide to see some of the positives, or if you take the negatives and say, you know what, I'm going to learn from it and I'll move on, then you'll understand and you'll move on and you'll experience more joy and happiness.
Tia, thanks so much for your call. It's really an interesting perspective. Decker, does it make sense to expect happiness in marriage?
Well, you know, we know, and I think Tia's comments are right on point, which is we know that in the long haul of marriage, the right combination of positive emotions, you know, things like compassionate love and gratitude are really important to the health of the marriage. But we also know, and I think that Tia points to a real risk by privileging happiness to such an extent, which is that there are pieces of marriage, you know, in the middle of marriage in your 40s and 50s that have been documented to be very difficult. You know, teens are in the house and so forth. And there, if we persist in thinking that happiness is the sole standard for a marriage, we really are, I think, led astray and we lose sight of the bigger picture. So I think she's right on point.
One of your commandments is to be able to tell your story, and you know, I've been preaching that commandment for a long time. To me, one of the essential components of being human is to be understood for who we are.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, well, and a show like this one is really about telling our stories, mm-hmm. and we need more of it. You know, storytelling is a human universal. There are parts of the brain that are part of meaning-making and narrative and storytelling. When you study hunter-gatherers, they spend big portions of the day joking around and telling all the little stories of social living, and we've lost some of that in our busy lives. And we know from this incredible science on storytelling that when you tell your story about the worst things in life, you know, physical abuse or going through a genocide or what have you, it strengthens you and it brings you closer to others. So it's right up there with the things we have to practice.
Well, I would lobby to include as one of the commandments to listening to stories, because I think that is just as essential. I think truly listening to the stories with compassion, listening talk about touching your vagus nerve, you know?
Dan, what a great recommendation. And I will, after this interview, I'll go revise my commandments. No, I love that. And
Do we need a supermajority to pass it? of your imaginary planet?
That's right. No, but I think that your point connects to something that people are really interested in today. Like, for example, the Ashoka Foundation is launching this World Empathy Project. And we know empathy on our children is on the decline, the understanding of others, right? And I think your recommendation is the strongest pathway to empathy, which is teach children and yourselves to listen to other people's stories.
Well,
and from there, everything begins.
All right. Now, let me stop you there. There's a lot of callers, and we have to get to them.
But okay.
You're touching on something I really want to pursue with you a little bit.
Sure.
About teaching children about empathy.
Yeah.
I would suggest, and we know some of this, children have empathy. They're almost born with it. And they lose it.
You know, it's incredible. There's work by Carolyn Zahn Wachsler at Wisconsin, Wernicke at Harvard, showing, you know, at about the 1 year of age, children show all kinds of empathetic behavior, altruistic behavior, compassionate behavior. They come in, and that's why I titled my book Born to Be Good, which is we come in wired to connect and to care. And then they face the barrage of media and troubles that can take it away from them. And our task is to figure out how to teach this stuff, how to teach empathy.
Yeah, or how to interrupt this unlearning process. You know, I've got a 3-year-old. My best friend is 3, and he's living with me, and. Mm. Just when he started to walk, I don't know if you recall, I'm in a wheelchair, but just when he started to walk, he like knew to hold doors open for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no, it's incredible how much kindness there is in young kids.
Yeah.
Excellent example.
Let's go back to our callers. We're talking with Dacher Keltner. He's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. And he's the director of the Greater Good Science Center. He's written Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about happiness, the good news, and the bad news. And let's go right to Mark. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Your previous guest talked about the negative aspects of too much happiness and momentarily alluded to the idea that sometimes negative emotions will enhance athletic performance. And it kind of reminded me of an experience when I was going through some unpleasant domestic stuff, that my ability to run and jog and sprint was markedly enhanced. So the question I have is there a way you can tap into the non-happy emotions to enhance athletic performance and yet still not be emotionally unhealthy in the process?
You mean how we can tap into the unhappy emotions without making people miserable?
It's more like you're running a race and you'd like to be able to win the race, and if you need to get angry to do that or be miserable to do that, then how do you tap into that making yourself miserable all the time?
I'm not so sure misery will do it, but maybe anger does. Do you have any thoughts about that, Decker?
Yeah, you know, I love the athletic context because it's really an illustration of how we take really violent emotions and convert them into games, right? Although games can be occasionally aggressive. But, you know, there are a couple of emotions that are critical to athletic performance, and I think kind of the competitive spirit that is a version of anger. People have studied triumph and a feeling of collective strength as a critical ingredient to athletic success. And your listeners may have heard about a funny study we did on touch, which is a very important part of all emotions, and how teams that sort of do the fist bumps and the chest bumps and the flying acrobatic hip bumps on the NBA basketball court do better during the season. So a lot of the negative emotions converted and channeled in right ways are good for athletics.
Well, there you have it. There's your answer. Thanks so much for your call, Mark. Let's stick with the phones. We've got Josiah on the line. Hi, Josiah.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I was just thinking, I learned like 8 years ago that happiness, for me at least, was very fleeting. Mm-hmm. It comes and goes. You have something great 1 second, the next second it's gone, and you're left with nothing. And I learned that I need to learn how to be content mm-hmm. when I'm in those states. Because then, you know, if you can be content in the weakest moment, you know, happiness, you know, is just that much better when you have it, but you're not left with nothing when it's gone.
Yeah.
Great point. Decker, what are your thoughts?
Well, I love the point. You know, that point is made in a lot of the great contemplative traditions like Buddhism, that we really have to accept all states that come through our bodies and minds because they're part of human nature, and they're also transient and fleeting, as you said. And I think one of the real risks that June alluded to of really pathologically privileging happiness is we don't teach our children and our individuals to be content and peaceful in negative states, which is just part of life. So I think it's a supremely important point.
Yeah, and we know, thanks for the call, Josiah, and we know that many can define stress as, you know, not allowing this moment to be this moment, always wanting this moment to be a different moment, and
exactly.
That ain't going to happen.
Yeah, it's well put.
Constant stress. Decker, you talked about trust as one of your commandments, but we can't will ourselves to trust. Isn't trust a byproduct of well-being, compassion, or even love?
Well, I think both are true. You know, Dan, I think that if you can construct a life that allows you a lot of compassion, you will just trust people. But the reason I prioritize trust is that it's one of these perspectives on human beings that we walk around with. Can I trust this guy, or is this guy going to screw me over? And we know from a lot of research a couple of things, which is that the more you trust other people, the better that relationship, be it a marriage or parent-child bond, or even a business interaction, the better that will go. And the second thing we know is trust is really just it's pretty low in the United States in many realms, regrettably, and it's something that you can work on. You know, you can hold good thoughts about other people, you can reinterpret their kind of problematic behaviors in a more humane way. So I really feel this is a skill that we can cultivate.
You know, there's in meditation, the Buddhists call it a metta meditation, mm-hmm. where it's a love meditation where you wish for strangers, you know, happiness and the roots of happiness. And then you wish for friends, then you wish for yourself, and then you wish for enemies. You just wish for the world, happiness and the roots of happiness. And, I mean, just that wish for the larger culture to be happy, you know, that changes our lives and that opens our hearts. You know, the hormone, the so-called trust hormone is oxytocin.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's there's a reason why it sounds like OxyContin. You know, it just opens up the brain. It feels good. That's the hormone, by the way, that gets released when we first fall in love.
It is. And, you know, and I love your description of the sort of these loving kindness meditations. They're in all kinds of contemplative practices and different ethical traditions. And oxytocin is this incredible little chemical produced, you know, in your brainstem that goes into your brain and body. And when you feel connected to others, when you feel generous, when you see your baby, when a woman gives birth, it's critically engaged in all of these opening processes, as you say, Dan. And it tells us that there's a lot of good in human nature.
Oh, my God. Far more good than bad. This 24-hour news cycle where, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and that's what we get fed to us, literally fed to us.
Yeah. Let's
go back to the phones. We've got Rita on the line. Hi, Rita.
Hi, Dan. I absolutely love your show, and I love this guest.
Yeah.
I love the conversation we're having right now. I have a story for you about happiness, and I'll keep it brief, but I spent 25 or more years in the corporate world. I invested in the Ivy League education. I was making tons and tons of money, but I was never happy, and I could not figure out what my problem was with why I wasn't happy. It seemed like I should be. But what I came to realize, and I later started my own radio show called Talking Angels, but it had to do with me being authentically true to who I am. And instead of trying to live up to others' expectations of me, really being who I am and being comfortable with who I am and being able to say who I am and act the way I'd like to act. In other words, putting the suit on every day was almost like a straitjacket. I couldn't wait to get out of that suit at the end of the day. I'm more a hippie flower child than I am a corporate nerd, and it was just such a relief for me when I actually got laid off a couple of years ago and spent the time to ask myself that question. What is it that makes me happy? And what I learned was I actually am intuitive, I'm psychic, I've been channeling. I know it may sound insane, but a lot of people have very strong intuitive powers and they just ignore them because they think they're going to be judged. But it's so helpful to work with people now, and that's what I do. I hold workshops, and I've developed a whole business around this new show.
Well, good for you, Reed. I'm glad. I appreciate your call. You know, appropriate to what she said, Dacre, I had a client who once said to me, after some very difficult life experiences throughout the course of our treatment, she looked at me and she said, "You know, Dan," she said, "I will never abandon myself again."
Yeah. And I think that there are a couple of critical insights that Rita offers for us, and they really map to the happiness literature. One is there's no set answer, right? You have to go inside to yourself and your family context and find the particular nuanced version of what is the meaningful life for you. It may be about reverence, Dan, as you said, or laughter, or pride, or what have you. The second thing, and Rita's story is so important for today, which is we know, I think it may have been one of my commandments too, that giving is one of the strongest pathways to happiness and triggers all kinds of great physiological responses. And I wish more executives channeled Rita's spirit to be to prioritize giving in their lives.
You know what? Something you just said shocked me, Decker.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I'm going to quote you.
Uh-oh.
You said, "I think it was one of my commandments." Who wrote the damn commandments in the first place? You know, these aren't like the Big Ten. These are the Keltner Ten.
Well, I hope it's in there.
Yeah.
Giving is so essential.
Yeah, it really is giving. And, you know, generosity to others can really change lives. I mean, I've written some personal stories about that.
Nice.
I want to say something else about Rita. In her opening sentence, she said, "Dan, I love your show, I love your guest, and I love this topic." So can we talk briefly about love in here and its role in life and well-being? Because I think, you know, that's number one for me. I think the more we love, the more contentment we find.
It is. And, you know, we love and compassion. We just did a whole TEDx here out in California on, you know, just spreading compassion and love. If your listeners are interested in it, it's TEDxGoldenGateEd.org. But, you know, my point on this, and absolutely, is, you know, we begin as caring beings, you know, with individual differences. We navigate through life, falling in love and experiencing different kinds of love. And it is the most potent pathway to the meaningful life. And the one caveat that I teach my undergrads here at Berkeley and the healthcare audiences I speak to and parent audiences is, you know, we have a culture that since the 13th, 14th century has really emphasized romantic, passionate love. And it's wonderful, and we've all felt its, you know, amazing delights. But there are many kinds of love, and my favorite is really compassionate love. And we find, and you probably talked about this on your shows, Dan, as people age, they start to tap into this great feeling of generativity and compassionate love. And I want to bring that to our culture's attention a little more.
Yeah, it's, you know, Stephen Post at the Center for the Study of Altruistic Love talks about that. He talks about altruistic love, a kind of a selfless love where there's no I, there's no expectation of getting anything back. It's just love for other, love of other.
And and it's back to your word, reverence, which is you just see others in this benevolent way, and it, you know, taps into agape and Confucianist ideas about Zen, and it's just a core.
And that's when the heart opens and stays open, and that's when we find contentment. Dacher, unfortunately, we're out of time. You know, like Rita said, I love you.
Well, I love your show, and I love your work, Dan, so thank you.
You don't love me, Dacher? I said I love you. All right. You laugh easily. I like that. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's an honor.
Dacher Keltner is a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. He's director of the Greater Good Science Center. Earlier, we heard from June Gruber. She teaches psychology at Yale University, where she directs the Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Lab. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to hear about newest research on ADD and ADHD. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Listen, we're asking our listeners to do a little reading assignment. We'll be talking with author Rachel Simon on June 27th about her new book called The Story of Beautiful Girl. Read it beforehand and then join our discussion on the 27th. It'll be a good one. The engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. Our interns are Emily Haas and Evan Pliz.